Good morning and welcome to MTSU on the Record. I'm Jenna Logue and we're coming to you from the campus of Middle Tennessee State University in Murfreesboro, Tennessee. Could Iraq have a successful democratic government? And if it were to manage a democracy, would that necessarily lead to peace in the region? Well, Steve Saunders, who is the interim director of MTSU's McNair Scholars Program, addresses these issues along with Dr. Karen Peterson, who is an assistant professor of political science here, in a book titled Prospects for Political Stability in a Democratic Iraq. And Steve and Karen are here today with us to help us dissect this weighty topic. Thanks for being here, you guys.
Thank you.
Okay. I'll start with Steve first. This work examines how countries function in clusters and how the type of governments in those countries, be they autocracies or democracies, affects prospects for peace. So set the stage, if you would, just by outlining your main argument with regard to autocracies and democracies and how they function when they are geographically clustered in proximity to one another.
Okay. Basically, what we found that if you have a democracy that's surrounded by mostly non-democracies, that's going to be a very warlike cluster. The second most warlike cluster is if you have autocracies or dictatorships surrounded by other dictatorships. And then if you have an autocracy surrounded by democracies, that's not warlike at all. And then if you have democracy surrounding democracy, it's peace.
So if you have Canada, Mexico, and the United States, all on the North American continent, all of which have democratic governments, and although we have had and do still have our differences over issues like trade and immigration, none of it has risen to the level of military conflict.
That's correct. We probably will not see a war between Canada, the U.S., and Mexico, except perhaps at the Olympics, but no open conflict.
Now, as this applies to Iraq, let's look at the micro picture before we look at the macro picture. Iraq's three major sects, Shias, Sunnis, and Kurds, have been at odds for such a long time. How does their sectarian friction play into this whole cluster theory?
We don't know, of course. We don't have a crystal ball. We don't know whether Iraq will become democratic as a federation in which all three groups are working together. If it does, however, then we would suggest that that cluster that they are in might be very warlike, because if you look at Iran, it's not a democracy. Turkey is. Syria is not. Jordan is not. Saudi Arabia is not, nor is Kuwait. So a democratic Iraq would be surrounded by mostly non-democracies. If they are successful in resolving their differences and working together, then a democratic Iraq could be, if our goal is peace, that might not be the best way to achieve it.
So if, say, there were, as Vice President Joe Biden advocates, a tripartite Iraq, and you split it into Sunni, Shiite, and Kurd portions with, or nations, as it were, which is not recommended by the 9/11 Commission, and a lot of people have said, no way in heck it'll ever come to pass, how would that fit into the cluster theory in that whole region? What kind of governments would you anticipate they had? Just we're talking hypothetically.
Right. In terms of clusters, that would create more of them, because you would have three states instead of just the one. And when you create more of them, you would have to look at which states surround them. And again, you would probably have more clusters with a democracy surrounded by non-democracies. So that would make things even worse from our perspective.
Karen, is a democracy in Iraq even possible as long as those three major sects remain at odds the way they have been?
Well, let me back up just a second and address this issue of sectarian tension. We don't look at conflict within the nation state itself. We're looking at conflict between states. But when you think about Iraq and you think about the fact that these divisions cross lines, in other words, the Kurds aren't just in Iraq, you know, they're in other neighboring countries. Shias and Sunnis are spread out through the Middle East. I think that in itself is going to best create tension and likely create a scenario for war. So we're not directly addressing that, but we do talk about it in the book because it's something you know, it's like the elephant in the room.
Right.
As far as can Iraq be democratic, Yeah, well, I mean, India is democratic. If India can be democratic, anyone can be democratic. Mm-hmm. I mean, I if there's any democracy that should never have made it, it's the Indian democracy. It's not perfect. We know it's not perfect. Ours isn't perfect. But yeah, Iraq could be democratic. I don't know that it's going to be an easy process. I mean, certainly it will be a painful process. It already has been. But it is possible.
Well, you mentioned India, and you're right about Israel and India, both democracies surrounded by neighbors that threaten their very security. Do their respective histories support the cluster theory?
I mean, Steve can speak to this a little bit. I think India and Israel are outliers, and in a statistical sense, Israel in particular, because I think they have a neighborhood that is probably less welcoming than any other nation state in the world. And India had, you know, the British political systems and British institutions in place at independence that really helped them make that transition. And India's neighbors, while they're not democratic, and certainly Pakistan is hostile to India, it's not quite the level of hostility that Israel faces. So I don't know, you want to fill in some gaps there?
In fact, Israel and India really got us to thinking about clusters because in a very superficial look at data from 1950 to 1991, we found that there were 21 interstate wars, and India and Israel were in 8 of them, or 38%. So, and both democracies, and we thought, well, what's going on here? Because democracies, at least in one sense of the democratic peace proposition, are supposed to be more peaceful. And here they were in all these wars, and they initiated 5 of those 8 wars. So that's really kind of what got us interested in this topic in the first place.
Yeah. That is a reflection of their neighborhood.
Absolutely.
So that brings that cluster idea into relief.
But even if you do have a democracy that is surrounded by autocracies, perhaps in one of those autocracies, you'll have people who look at the democracy with envy or yearning, wish for their own democratic movement, try to start it within the autocracy, and then does the autocratic government have to really slam the hammer down in order to maintain its power? And that would stifle the growth of a democracy within that, or democratic aspects within that government?
Not only do they see their neighbors having a say in government, but generally the standard of living is higher too, and so you've got all of these things going on. And what the leaders in the autocracy may do is increase their security apparatus because for fear of internal rebellion, but they may also be more hostile to their neighbors as well, and that's where the interstate war comes in.
Where does the U.S. fit into this, given the fact that we're a democracy surrounded by democracies on the same continent, but because we have military scattered all over the globe, it could be argued that we're very militaristic and warlike?
Well, we're measuring actual war, so you know the capability for war isn't in and of itself war. So we're measuring, you have to actually engage in conflict and people have to die in order to make it into the data set, so just the possibility doesn't really make it into the data set. However, one of probably the most vexing questions we had was, how do you deal with the U.S.? Because the U.S. has such force projection capability that theoretically it could be argued that they are a member of every cluster because we have the capability to do that. Ultimately, we decided to force the U.S. to play statistically by the same rules as everyone else. So that's the way we decided to deal with that. But certainly you can make the argument that we are members of a lot of clusters where we're members of clusters where we're surrounded by autocracies and, of course, other democratic clusters. And we know that democracies have conflict with autocracies. It's not that democracies aren't conflict prone. I mean, they do engage in conflict. They just do not engage in conflict with other democracies.
Was this all easier to formulate during the Cold War when you had the U.S. and the USSR as two superpowers, and Western Europe, you could say, was one bloc, and then the Eastern European countries would represent another bloc or group of clusters?
In part. But if I could, Gina, just back up a little. It was an excellent question that you just asked about the United States' involvement in the world. Because the United States has military bases of one sort or another in 130 countries out of 192, You're absolutely right. I mean, as Dr. Peterson mentioned, we could be considered part of every cluster of in the world. And so there is the issue. So far, the United States and only the United States is able to project that power worldwide. And even we feel some strains when we get more than two wars going. It's very tough. But we're the only state now that can do that. But as you heard, statistically, we defined it as being contiguous, door to door, next door neighbors. But that is an issue. Certainly is an issue.
Mm-hmm. And to the follow-up question about during the Cold War, the U.S. and the Soviet Union, was it easier to divide up the geographic pie into clusters at that time because we had our allies and they had theirs?
There were fewer states, so yes, yeah. In that respect, it was easier because instead of 142, there were, a dozen less or more?
The former republics of the now defunct Soviet Union are, since they're now independent nation states, how would you say that they are clustering, if at all? Or is there so much friction between Kazakhstan and Uzbekistan and Ukraine and all the other republics that they're not clustering?
I think we need to clarify a little bit about what that means, okay. Clustering. The way we define cluster is if two states are contiguous, mm-hmm. and so that means they share a common border or separated by a river or 12 or up to 200 miles of water. It's not as if a state can get up and move to another neighborhood. I mean, that's just where right. they are. But what we're finding, of course, is with a lot more independent states, there are a lot more clusters now, and so it makes our analysis more complicated. Mm-hmm.
Or the majority of, this wasn't the main focus of your book, but are the ex-Soviet states, are more of them autocratic than democratic? Or
it depends on where you look. I mean, the stand countries are still stand countries, and they're like they were before.
Yeah.
they're autocratic, and that's not surprising, I don't think.
Hard to give that up when that's what you've been used to since 1917.
And it's not just that. I mean, it's they are proximate to other democracies. And so if you look at former Soviet countries, the ones that are closer to Western Europe, the ones that, you know, share sort of a cultural affinity, like the Polands of the former Soviet Union, have done very well. You know, they've been able to make a transition to, but for the most part, democracy or something that resembles it. And the closer you get to Russia, the weaker that democracy becomes. And then, of course, when you move into Central Asia, then there really is no democracy in that region. And I think it's a product of geography and probably partly culture.
Mm-hmm. Going back to Iraq, what about Iran? The UN Atomic Agency believes that Iran's working on a nuclear missile payload. The Ayatollah Khamenei denies this. Iran is autocratic, so given Iran and Iraq's tortured relationship, how does that factor into the equation?
Well, certainly one thing we have to keep in mind is Iran is in that cluster, the Iraq-centered cluster. And currently Iran does have quite a bit of influence in Iraq. And so, you know, that may change in the future, but currently their aim apparently is to have a nuclear capability, not just for peaceful purposes, and it's going to be very difficult to stop that. But in that area, then, we have more and more nuclear powers. If these kinds of clusters are inherently more warlike and you add nuclear capability on top of it, it's a very volatile situation.
Beyond the analytical stage, what can be done with this type of analysis in terms of being proactive or reactive? Or is it just interesting information to know in the process of formulating foreign policy?
I mean, I think we have a situation here where the evidence that we bring to bear on this important question screams at policymakers, your assumptions about democratizing these types of countries, you know, might be wrong. You know, we're scientists, so we don't say we're definitely, we know 100%, but there's a pretty strong probability that democratizing Iraq is not going to bring peace to this region, and that is part of the explicit policy goal of democratizing this regime.
It raises questions about the whole Bush 43 nation building concept.
Any other nation building concept as well. I mean, any attempts at nation building, particularly, you know, that are started externally, are problematic. If you have a democratic transition ongoing and you assist with a democratic transition that was, I don't want to call it grassroots because that generally doesn't happen, but that was at least local, it's a different story. If you come in and externally impose a democratic governance in a region like this with the assumption that it's going to bring peace to a region that's been essentially, as far as human history is concerned, has been conflictual, that assumption, it's not supported by the evidence. I believe that.
I agree. Yeah. Many presidents, aside from Bush, have said the same thing. Reagan and Clinton have all appealed to the democratic view. Spreading democracy will bring peace to the world. The problem is, while that may be true, if you intervene and promote democracy at the fringes of other democracies, I think then, yes. But if you go into a state in the middle of a bunch of autocracies, then I would say no.
Is it not also owing to the fact that Iraq in its entire history has never had a democratic rubric of any kind? No precedent from which to build that was internal. It's almost as if the action of the unilateral democracy is intended to be solely inspirational, one shining guiding light, which sort of insults the intelligence of the native population. Feel free to disagree.
I would say, for example, the Kurds certainly have been functioning as a democracy. They do come out of that heritage, but they seem to have adapted, in my view at least, to democracy very, very well in a very short time. So I don't see that as perhaps a deal breaker.
Is that because they perhaps were more sympathetic to the Bush military action from the get-go because of Saddam's actions against them and their people?
Certainly that, and they really have been pushing for independence, no question. That could be part of it. Mm-hmm.
Well, they have a large expatriate community that's westernized. And if you look at the Middle East, you know, you have democracy in Israel. The state of Israel is established by a bunch of people who moved in from Western countries with sort of Western democratic ideals. You have Kurds, large expatriate communities in Western countries that are still incredibly active in local politics. That's going to, I guess, serve as an incubator for democratic ideals. And certainly if you want the sympathy of the West in terms of independence or autonomy, then you aren't going to go down the road of authoritarian rule. You're going to tell us what we want to hear, which is what the Kurds would do. I mean, that's what I would do.
Since the Kurds are everywhere, and for many of them, they would like nothing more to have one nation state that they could call their own. Is it just a pipe dream for them to expect that to happen, given the various conflicts and tensions in the region, especially with Turkey?
There are 14 million or so Kurds in Turkey, and I don't know how many more in Iran, but there is the dream of Kurdistan, either to be semi-autonomous or independent. One of the things that we talked about in the book is Turkey, of course, doesn't want to have a whole chunk of its country sliced off to go to Kurdistan, and Turkey is democratic. So you would have two democracies at odds over this issue, and perhaps Turkey would be willing to do just about anything, including war, to prevent that from happening. One of the things we mentioned in the book, that one way perhaps around this would be something that's not been tried on this larger scale, and that's mass migration of 14 million people. And that would be a huge undertaking, and it might be the very worst option there is, except for war.
It's probably not, okay, there's no way to say this and for it not to sound mean, but it probably is a pipe dream, and here's why. Because unsettling state borders is dangerous. One of the most dangerous types of disputes, actually the most dangerous type of dispute between states, is border disputes and territorial conflict. And so one of the things that the nation-state system, while it exists, and it's not a given that this will always exist, is to keep these borders solidified and keep them stable. Creating Kurdistan would disrupt borders for at least three other states in addition to Iraq. And that would be a formula for some potentially intense conflict. That, I think, is the reason why there's not as much political will to even if we have a sympathetic heart, and I have a lot of Kurdish students and I love them dearly, and I am sympathetic to their argument, but history, they lost out historically, and I think that it's unlikely that that's going to be rectified anytime soon, if at all, and it may be very dangerous to try to do that. It may not be the best option at this point for anyone, even the Kurds, and I know that that's, again, it's not that I'm not sympathetic to that argument. It's just, from a realistic perspective, it's probably dangerous to try to do something like that.
It's difficult to envision it happening.
Well, and this was part of this whole Wilsonian idea of, giving autonomy and, self-governance to all of these different nations without really taking time to recognize the consequences of that can be very violent. And if you talk about mass migration, if you just look at the partitioning of the Indian subcontinent, I don't know that we don't even know the exact figures, but up to 1 million people died just moving Muslims and Hindus back and forth between Pakistan and India. So that migration in itself was very deadly, and of course their relationship is less than ideal.
Part of the whole problem of colonization and then in nations becoming independent, the superpowers thought they could just put the boundaries wherever they wanted to without regard to tribal issues or anything else, and we'll put the boundaries here, there, here's a river, we'll draw it here, we'll draw the map any way we want to, and we won't have any adverse consequences because we're the big shots, we know what we're doing.
I've always sort of felt that way, but we mentioned this in the book, and it may very well be that any other way would have worked out just as bad, if not worse. If you think about Africa, and I was just looking at this again today, a lot of the conflict in Africa is internal. It's what we call intrastate war, and it's because these boundaries are what we call artificial. But if we'd drawn correct boundaries, if we could somehow figure out where people belonged and draw boundaries around nations, then what we might have ended up with in Africa is a bunch of wars between these states instead of inside. And there's no reason to believe that those would have been any less deadly or any less damaging. There would be any less grabs for resources than there are now. So it may be you're right. Mm-hmm. Right, I know you're right, and we all know you're correct, but it may not be that there was a solution that was any better other than to rewind the clock and never colonize. Mm-hmm. I mean, that would probably be the only way. And then again, we don't really know if that would have been any better.
Ask the Sudanese, which is worse, a multi-nation war or a civil war, right?
Right.
And that is, when you have a state and a nation being the people and state being the government, with different boundaries, there's going to be pressure. There's going to be problems. But as Dr. Peterson mentioned, that Africa is very peaceful. If you look at them from the interstate level, as you mentioned, there's not much war between states there. But it's very violent if you look within states. Whether new boundaries would eliminate the civil wars and add to interstate wars, I mean, that is a real possibility.
And to throw another knuckleball into the mix, asymmetrical warfare. Groups like Al-Qaeda, the Taliban, it's not about borders and nation states for them. They don't operate that way.
As for, yes, for our analysis, of course, we do not deal with anything other than states, but there are all sorts of complications out there, and we chose this part of that issue. But if Al-Qaeda were to be able to take a leadership position in a government. Now that would be a different issue altogether, as we see in Palestine. And then, if a terrorist group becomes a state, then we're looking at a cluster again.
Do you think that the Western democracies have grown weary of nation building in other countries through democracy on the basis of painful experience?
I just had this conversation with my students this morning. I mean, we have managed to successfully build democracies 2.5 times. Germany, Japan, and South Korea. And South Korea is a democratic now, but you know, Germany and Japan are clear examples of successful externally imposed democratic experiments. And the cost for those two democracies is astonishing. So I don't know that we've grown weary. I don't know that we've learned our lessons, if you will. I think, again, I don't think that anything in this book says you shouldn't be involved in assisting democratization if it occurs without your external stimulus. In other words, if you have a democracy brewing in a country, there's nothing wrong with assisting in the development of that democracy as long as you do it correctly and you don't sort of, well, I guess if we could figure out how to do that. I mean, Russia's a good test case of how we didn't do that very well. But you know, I don't think Western countries have tired of that, because there's still inherent in Western ideas, Western philosophy, something that equates democracy with good governance. Mm-hmm. And so we want to encourage that and spread that. And it's probably not untrue. I mean, if you look at non-democratic governments, they've been incredibly brutal. The more people have died at the hands of dictators in the 20th century than in all the wars combined. So we don't want to encourage Stalin and Mao and that type of governance. We do want to encourage democratic governance, and we probably should continue to do that, just not, we should not impose that and expect that to be a painless process. If we're willing to pay the cost like we did with Japan and Germany, then we can be successful. Mm-hmm.
What about just, maybe this sounds naive and quaint, but what about just going back to the idea of not attempting blatantly to build a democracy, but just attempting to win hearts and minds through organizations like the Peace Corps and foreign aid and such as that, not necessarily with the aim of trying to build a democracy in that country, but just to win friends?
Mm-hmm. If you look at the exchange programs between the United States and China, for example, a lot of that's going on. MTSU is part of that. I think it's terrific. How much impact that has, I don't know for sure. This is really kind of outside our area, but my area at least. But I think that these kinds of efforts, not everything has to be driven by the government. A lot of grassroots things can happen. I think that's terrific. The more the better. And that would partially speak to your earlier question, whether democracies are weary of this. If this is a voluntary effort, there is no impact on the government. There is no reason for the American government to be weary, or any other European government to be weary, if this is happening voluntarily.
Are there any hybrid governments you can think of that have both autocratic and democratic features that make things complicated in terms of looking at clusters?
Tons of them. Maybe you should be the one to address this question, but
there are a lot of states that are either, you know, have this, this measure that we use to measure democracy is quite detailed and complex, and so you can end up with states in somewhere in this fuzzy middle range that they're not entirely autocratic, but they're certainly not what we would recognize as a liberal democracy. And just depending on how closer they are to one or the other, you know, that's how they end up being classified. And we actually err on the caution of not classifying things as democratic unless they clearly meet a cut point for liberal democracy. So you have illiberal democracies in this autocracy category.
The book is called Prospects for Political Stability in a Democratic Iraq. And who put this together? Edwin Millen Press. Available on Amazon.com. Steve Saunders and Dr. Karen Peterson, thanks for being with us today.
Thank you
very much. This is MTSU on the Record. I'm Jenna Loeb. Join us again at the same time next Sunday, 8 a.m. Central Time. Don't forget, you can check out the podcast at your leisure at mtsunews.com, and we're also available on iTunes.